Hi, I'm Jeff Sagenfield, CTO here at Keycode Media. We're going to be talking about the Grow Your Career in Color and Finishing with our panelists, and we're going to have everybody introduce themselves. Just easier that way. Rory, let's start with you.
Hi, my name is Rory. I'm a colorist. I was previously at Arsenal for about 9 years, and I'm making a transition to Keep Me Posted / Photochem. I've done about 130 episodes of HDR content, and I love psychophysics and vision and perception and painting. So there you go.
Hi, I'm Tahira Foy. I currently work as a senior colorist at Arsenal Effects and Color, but previously I was in the internal team at HBO. I have a background in online editing as well as color. And yeah, I've worked on current kind of series. And at HBO, I was doing restoration. We did 98 episodes of Sex and the City from Film Scans, which was a lot of fun. And yeah, I'm excited to talk to you guys about finishing color.
Awesome. Michael?
I brought a bunch of notes with me. Sorry, guys. I'm a Emmy Award-winning colorist and editor. Been in the biz for about 30 years. I gained notoriety in L.A. when I was one of the first colorists to use the Avid Media Composer to do color. And, of course, since they've transitioned to DaVinci. I'm currently working on Naked and Afraid, but I've also worked on Entertainment Tonight, American Idol, Disney's The Odd Life of Timothy Green, and I've done commercial work for Neiman Marcus, Kaiser, and Lexus.
Excellent. So let's jump on into it. And remember, we're partially talking education here. So that's going to be a little bit of the focus here. But we'll start with Tahira on this one. At what point would you say you transformed into the role of a professional colorist or professional editor? And can you share your journey from entering the industry to becoming a proficient editor, colorist, and post-production expert?
I guess maybe I'll start with the journey because it's a pretty windy journey to get to where I'm at now as a colorist. But when I first kind of got into post-production was in grad school. I went to Emerson College. And kind of, I joke and say when you're in the entertainment industry, you kind of have to choose your chaos. And as they introduced us to the various aspects of pre-production, production, and post, I was like, oh, post, I like that. I worked at a film lab. We had Avids, we had a Resolve. That's kind of where I really started getting more into editing and color. I came out to LA to intern. I interned with a short form promo company. And, you know, I realized that just straight out of grad school, I didn't think I was going to be just a finishing colorist on a long form show right away. There were definitely steps. But post-production was my passion. So then in short form, I worked as a post coordinator and a post supervisor. I then also worked as a coordinator in long form. I was in the Walking Dead universe, Fear the Walking Dead. And I gained a great relationship with our online and finishing team there. And that's kind of where I transitioned into online editing. And I was like, hey, can I also color assist? 'Cause I'm into that as well. So from there, kind of helped out with dailies, helped out with color tracing in Resolve. After that, I went back into kind of short form promo doing color. And we would also do specials. And then from there, I got the opportunity to join the restoration team at HBO. And that was great. Kind of learning a different, looking at a known grade, but kind of working with the team. I worked with another amazing colorist, John Reed, to kind of match what people knew, but enhance it for our new display technologies. I'm currently working on a docuseries for Hulu. I did a season of a dramedy called Average Joe on BT+. And I did a Hallmark movie called Rescuing Christmas. But that was kind of my journey into color. I've always had a passion for painting. I do film photography on the side. So I kind of was just trying to find my way in, and I found that way in through post coordinating, post supervising.
Awesome. Michael, tell us about your journey.
Yeah, I was kind of born into this. My dad was in the business. He worked for Columbia Pictures, and he got into post-production. And, you know, when I was a toddler, I had an Instamatic camera. So I was always into photography. I became a professional photographer. I did the weddings and the bar mitzvahs and all that. And all along, I've been learning editing with videotape. And my sister was working for this executive producer who was producing a documentary for Bing Crosby. And he hated the editor so much, he fired him. And my sister said, well, you know, my brother's an editor. And he was editing on this system called D-Vision, which was one of the first nonlinear editing systems. And so I had to learn how to edit on that. So I went from tape to learning on this thing called D-Vision. And from there, I worked at a bank doing their training videos. I ended up going to work for a reseller that sold Avids. And they paid for me to get trained on the Avid. And I ended up doing a lot of Avid demos. And then Avid hired me. And then a company in LA called 3 Point Digital, which is kind of the, you know, the beginnings of Key Code at some point. They hired me as a demo artist. And Michael Kavanaugh, who runs this company, he always introduced me as the premier colorist in Hollywood. I wasn't, but that's what he introduced me as. And I said, okay. And so that started getting around. And then I got a job at Dick Clark Productions. And it just bloomed from there. And done a lot of stuff. Look up my IMDb page. I can't. This did a lot. But that's basically how it came about.
Awesome. D-Vision, 1993, by the way.
Yeah.
Rory, tell us about your journey.
I went to RIT. Imaging was, yeah, right? Did you thaw out finally, or are you still frozen? go Tigers. I was always interested in like photo M&P classes. I did actually one of the last Vision 3 test shoots up there, I think, is that 250D, I think? I think it was 250D, 5219. Worked on that that test shoot up there and got to, you know, be on set with some of the engineers came out as well. And then when I moved to Los Angeles, I thought I wanted to be on set and quickly realized I do not have the phenotype for set life. I was like, stand around for 12 hours. I don't know. I'd rather sit in a dark room by myself for 8 hours and do it that way instead. So I was hired in Daly's lab, the 24P. Daily's lab doing dailies for Sony. And I worked nights and sat in with colorist Randy Starnes over at Colorworks and Scott Ostrowski and Matt Lear. They're all really generous with me with their knowledge. And I basically was just didn't sleep for a few years there. And then eventually moved over to Arsenal and assisted. I did dailies a little bit there too. Moved to assisting Randy and Larry Field with Final Color. And then I've been as a senior colorist, I don't remember the year, but for a minute. Had the opportunity to work with a lot of DPs and see a lot of other colorists work. And dailies is a really great place to start because it's a great way to kind of get your 10,000 hours in, especially if you work on a courtroom drama, am I right? Dimble to Kim, courtroom drama, yeah. I see not a lot of people have. so that's brings me here.
Excellent. So skills play a crucial role in success as a colorist. Now, you mentioned the dark rooms. A lot of color bays are very dark rooms with very comfortable couches, kind of similar to a therapist's office. It's really interesting that way. So besides mastering the software, what other skills have contributed to your journey and your success? What advice would you offer to assistant colorists or aspiring to become lead colorists, particularly focusing on soft skills? What are you telling those who approach you wanting to get into the biz? Michael, let's start with you on this one.
Start with photography. Learn about how light affects the image and how the image gets from either your camera or your phone to the finished product on your computer screen or on a broadcast monitor. There's, even if you have an iPhone, that's great. There's another Android. There's an app called Halide that basically turns the iPhone camera into a fully manual, where you have to adjust every part of the white balance, the emulsion, the wet film, shutter speed, iris, all that. So you don't have to pay a lot of money to get into learning about imagery and photography. And then take that image and bring it into Photoshop, or if you want the free version, it's called GIMP.org, and play with light and make mistakes and try to make it better, and then hit the reset button and do it again. And you'll be amazed in that you can take the same image and color it 12 different ways. And that's a really good way to start learning being a colorist. Second most important is social networking. That's a skill you need to develop. I highly recommend you go to the National Association of Broadcaster Convention, which is coming up next month. We end next, no, two, well, April. Oh, yeah. And they have a, there's a colorist mixer where you can rub shoulders with some of the biggest colorists in the world. And you can meet people from Blackmagic, who was there. And I was picking their brains. They were picking my brains. It was great. And I have a friend who I've known for years who's a colorist, and I said, asked him, you know, the footage I deal with, they're parting with the iris a lot. And so you have to offset that so it's all one exposure. And so my friend Tal was there. Shout out to Tal. And he gave me a trick using a plugin, and it's saved me hours and hours of time. So social networking, get on the Facebook groups. There's a website called Mixing Light, which is a great place to learn. And you can also talk to other colorists. The Blue Collar Post Collective here in Los Angeles is another great networking group. And finally, the Los Angeles Creative Pro User Group, they meet once a month, and they have great content and good networking for those shows.
A meeting yesterday.
Yeah, yeah.
Yep. Rory, skills with a Z.
With a Z. Well, I think the color skills need to be so second nature that it's something that is, you can get into flow state very easily, because another very important part of color, and I would say actually the medium that we use almost as much as light is a temporal element, is time. Because one of our biggest jobs is to make all the cuts in an edit disappear, make all the shots flow shot to shot to shot. But the other important thing is that we're, especially in episodic land, we got to get through 900 shots in 2 days, or, you know, maybe that's a beefy episode. Maybe it's less than that, but you know, we got to get through all those shots that fast. And then I think the soft skills can be just as technical as the knowing about, you know, display targets and calibration and all of that, because it is important to make people to focus people back to what their original intent was on set, and to just really reassure them that they've made good decisions. And it's our job to let their decisions that they already made it on set, shine. So that's what I would say, is focus on your time management, and focus on your matching, and focus on making people comfortable.
Awesome. Hira?
Just echoing kind of what both of you all have said, I think emphasis on play is really important. Because this is the space to kind of try out some things, even though, you know, like Rory was saying, DP does have kind of set looks. I think it's also important to remember, especially working in television, that things that you do will often need to be done at scale, and you do have delivery dates. So, you know, it's great to know how to key and window small things, but remember, a DP has kind of lit something for you, and kind of there was an established kind of look in monitoring. And then when you get into those spaces, knowing that, hey, if I do this on one shot, I need to be able to do this on scale. And then sometimes if it's episodic in spaces that repeat, it might not just be on scale for that episode. You might need to be able to do that on scale for the season. So keeping that in mind. And then with soft skills, DPs, EPs, when they come into the color bay, they're bringing you something that's not done yet. So it's a very kind of vulnerable space. So I think it's very important to be to just work on social communication skills, helping to put people at ease and say, hey, this is the space where we're gonna fine tune. This is the space that's okay. We can try something that doesn't work. No one's ever going to see that. We're going to make sure that when it's out, it feels good. So just kind of creating that space and understanding, I guess, listening and building that language and rapport so that you know when your EP or your DP is saying something, you can kind of help execute that, understanding their color language and their visual language. I think that's a great soft skill to have.
Everybody needs to be talking the same language, yeah.
Kicking off of that, I think having a solid color management workflow and having your note tree can be whatever you want, but having a system that really works for you so that you can do what Tahira is saying and like play and, you know, have fun and be able to make someone feel like, hey, you know, we can try something. You can, you know, audition this or, you know, fly it in and see if it works, fly it out. that's, you know, a dovetail of the technical and the soft.
Yeah,
definitely. So over the years, not how, but what have you witnessed in the evolution of color grading? What software and hardware advancements have made your job easier? And then additionally, how have workflow enhancements and tool sets improved? And have you observed any influences from outside the traditional post-production space on these tools? Rory, let's start with you.
Yeah. Well, certainly display tech being in everybody's pocket, better and better and better, but also more and more diverse surrounds and more diverse displays. That's definitely a curveball. I would say from like end-to-end production, the ability with which we are able to transmit color decisions from dailies through finishing has increased a lot. You know, from just a show LUT to a show LUT plus CDLs, plus now there's AMF, which allows, you know, ACES metadata files allowing us to translate, to document a color pipeline from dailies to VFX, which is really helpful in terms of, like, you know, being able to have effects in the offline that translate from different settings. But yeah, the display tech in people's pockets rapidly changing and their, you know, ability to watch content in a lot of different surrounds is for sure a big old question mark.
Went from $37,000 monitors on the desk to, you know, it's an iPad Pro. It's in my backpack. No big deal. Tahira, what do you think?
Yeah, I'd have to piggyback off that. And even just in a small amount of time with kind of COVID, I know as a colorist kind of before COVID, the idea of someone reviewing at home on a consumer monitor was like, I don't know. So, I mean, you know, now we have OLED displays, different color front, Resolve. I think Resolve has a remote option now where we can manage some of the color pipeline and people can actually see something very close to what's in the bay in a home space. I think that's phenomenal. I don't know, for me personally, as I grew as a colorist, I grew in the panels, you know, starting at the minis and moving to the larger panels and just kind of building that muscle memory. I don't know if that's trending overall, but that is definitely something that has changed for me. I think it's also interesting to see film as an aesthetic is something that you know, we had, and then we moved more into our digital space, and now we're moving into another space where people kind of want some of the aesthetics of film, or people are building pipelines in that can include film in different portions of the color workflow. I think that's also very interesting and exciting. And it's cool to see it change as time goes on.
Michael, thoughts on the subject?
Well, there is a reason why NVIDIA is now one of the top three corporations in the country. It's the graphics card business. It's the thing that pushes the pixels that's gotten lightning and lightning faster, exponentially faster, unlike regular, you know, CPUs. Everything's being done on the graphics card. And boy, Apple Silicon has just blown the doors off. I guess you saw the video. You know, I'm driving 4 monitors off a MacBook Pro M1 Max. You know, that's crazy. So, yeah, pay attention to Apple Silicon, NVIDIA. As far as AI goes, there is a software that's in development called ColorLab AI. You can find it at colorlab.ai, and it's Kalur, like the British spell it. The stuff I've seen preliminary and what that thing can do is pretty spectacular. I don't see it at all as replacing us, but helping do a lot of the minutiae that we do as colorists, maybe the white balance, maybe getting a show look onto your show. It does save a lot of time. And, you know, when COVID, when we had to go from, you know, we'd have a show day where I would show my color grading to an audience, the executive producers, the director, et cetera, and we all got notes at the same time. Well, now that I'm working from home, put it up on Frame.io, and they're watching it on whatever the hell they want to watch it on and giving me notes. We don't have that interaction anymore. So, but I think there's also built into DaVinci Resolve remote monitoring, which is really, really cool. So, and it only has an iOS app, so it forces you to use the iPad, which has a really good OLED screen. And in real time, I can say, well, do you like this better? Do you like this better? And they can be a million miles away and we'll be able to work. So I'm very excited about AI and technology. But I think our jobs are safe for a long time.
I would think so as well. I mean, the first time I ever saw any kind of a color bay, it was 1991. And it was probably film, and they turned that apple from red to green, and we all just lost our minds because how do you do that? Because it was not something you'd seen in the tools before. People were living in, you know, 3/4 in VHS tapes back then. So it's amazing how far things have come. DaVinci Resolve is our esteemed sponsor tonight. Let's share your experiences with Resolve. Are you utilizing the latest offerings? And how was the transition from older versions to newer versions for you? Any initial concerns? How do they pan out in reality? And in the tradition of Editor's Lounge, are there things you want Blackmagic to address with your workflows and workday? Let's start.
I've onlined in Resolve and I've done color in Resolve. So kind of edit tab, color tab, delivery tab, media tab. Those are like my, if I had my like custom workspace, that's what the bottom of my screen does. I think each iteration of Resolve, there's always some new tool or open effects that I find myself tinkering with. I was thinking just about something that I kind of used of recent. In the edit tab, there's an edit index, which is really cool for nodes. So I've had producers, this was more when we were remote, we showed a producer how to make markers in the edit tab for color notes or online notes that she could then export out to us. And I would use the edit index. I'd see a thumbnail of the shot. You've got the time code right there. Double click on the time code takes you right to the spot that carries over into the color tab. So that made my work onlining and doing color. This was on a restoration project. It just made it that much faster. So just having those tools where online and finishing are talking to color very fast has been amazing. I'm a big color coder, so my tracks are always color coded and separated out. So just little things like that. Like I said, every iteration, there's always something fun. I don't know. One wish list for me, sometimes in and outs don't always carry over from tab to tab. Small gripe, but yeah, other than that, Resolve has been amazing. As I gave my color journey in grad school, I started in Resolve, and I've been kind of in Resolve ever since for color. So yeah.
Magic Mask in DaVinci was a game changer for me. It really saves me a ton of time, because I only give 3 days to to grade 750 clips. And if I want to do anything fancy, I got to do it fast. So Bravo on the magic masks. I recently had to remove a tripod from a shot, and I did that in Fusion. Now, I thanks to the union, I was able to get a free course in Fusion. I got a certificate, but if you don't use it, you forget everything. And so it took me a while, but I was able to paint out a tripod of a shaky camera and someone walking in front of it. I encourage you to learn Fusion. My requests, feature requests, I'd like a button to advance to the next ungraded clip. And pro tip, most of us have what are called node trees, where we don't just start with one node on a show. We actually have a pre-made template of maybe 10, 20, whatever nodes. And when you apply that node to a shot, even though there's nothing going on in that node, DaVinci calls it a graded shot, like it marks it as already colored. And so I'd love to be able to add a node tree and still be able to have it marked as not graded.
Yeah. Sorry, too close. Yeah, definitely. I think, because I've used a lot of color correctors. I've used Baselight. I also was a Lustre user for a long time. And the ability, the one thing that I do actually still kind of miss about Lustre is the ability to like drop down a parameter and copy something very, very specific from shot to shot. Like I just want to copy saturation from, you know, like I want to change saturation. I want to do it in the same node that might have a balance in it across, you know, a whatever 15 shot scene. So that would be very helpful. I use Aces color management in Resolve a lot, and that implementation works great. I also am a big flagger and any kind of organization. I use group grades a lot to be able to like fly in overall corrections. So, you know, being able to group and sort by groups is really, really, really clutch and helpful for me. So, yeah.
Sure.
So, surprise. with the edit index, it just hit me. If there, and this might be more for finishing, so if online does notes and it's in their EDL, you can bring the EDL in as timeline markers, which is glorious. So then you have the markers from offline, and when you open the edit index, you can see their notes. So another fun fact.
With Frame.io, you can, people can make notes on Frame.io, and you can download those notes and have it go right to your timeline, which is very cool.
Well, I'm seeing some note-taking around here, which is really good. And one thing I'd like to call out is the plugin manufacturers. In the spirit of Open Timeline.io, if you have a plugin that works in both, you know, say Premiere and Resolve or Avid and Resolve, license the plugin to the machine so that you have it in both apps, so you don't have to buy it for the separate apps, because we need those effects to transfer back and forth. You are the holdup to Open Timeline.io. Stop being the roadblock. All right. I'll get off my soapbox. Reflecting on the current state of overall post-production in the industry, what are your concerns or predictions for the upcoming year or so? Any emerging trends or challenges you foresee as a worry? Michael, start with you on that one.
First up would be globalization. You know, DaVinci's free. It's free for anyone in any city in the world, and they can learn it, become great at it. And, you know, production companies are trying to cut every freaking dime right now, and they will start outsourcing. They already have, but I think we're going to see more of that. Budgets are not going to get bigger. They're going to get smaller, and they're going to try to squeeze every dime you can. And, you know, shocker, coloring, grading is one of the last things on the budget. And if they've overspent in production, they have to make up for it in post-production. And so we get squeezed a lot. And just the consolidation of the job, you know, I was talking, I did a paint out, you know, colorists are being asked to do more and more things. Onliners be asked to do more and more things that are outside the scope, like graphics and titles and paintouts. So those are concerns.
Rory?
Yeah, well, you know, surviving the two strikes and then whatever's going to happen this summer, that would probably be my biggest concern. And, you know, making sure that our, like, siblings on set are surviving as well, because it's just been such a shakeup of a year. I think that is the concern, as Michael is saying, is like where the stuff stops rolling. So it's important. We're just really hopeful that we're able to get everybody back to work and get. I think it's also really difficult for anybody to predict. There's so much, you know. I think fear and unknown at the moment, that probably the most constructive thing to do is to lean into skills, actually, is to lean into projects that, like, things that you can actually learn on your own, or personal projects, or things that you can, can drive you forward as a technician, as an artist, as a person. So that's, yeah, exactly.
What do you think?
Yeah, just kind of echoing both a trend towards kind of shorter and shorter amounts of time.
Oh,
and DI is something that, you know, we're kind of combating. And then also, I think we're seeing some more decentralized workflows within post, where you might be working across time zones or continents, even between color and online. So balancing those things out. And yeah, you know, this industry we've had a rough couple of years, but we've kind of made it through. And, you know, for all of the unknowns that kind of induced fear, there's still unknowns that can actually be a bright spot, I guess, to kind of lift it back up. So as there are a lot of things that are changing, I think back to just my restoration kind of past, and what, you know, the possibilities that are on the horizon that we just don't know about yet. The fact that display technology changed the way that it did is allowing us to show shows in new ways for people to experience at home. So just echoing, like I said before, even though there are some fears and uncertainties, or uncertainties that may kind of induce fears, there's uncertainties that can be a beam and a bright light, just as people can see things, I don't know if I want to say better, but in a new, more enhanced way at home, then they're going to lean on us as creatives to help that shine. So
there are opportunities. So looking ahead about 2 years, let's say 9 months, how do you anticipate storytelling evolving for editors and colorists? We're in that kind of fast cycle now. Do you think there's going to be significant advancements, such as AI-driven tools in the generative space? Or do you foresee more subtle changes, perhaps focusing on repetitive or metadata-type tasks? Rory, let's start with you.
Storytelling changing, not technology changing?
Technology changing the way we tell stories.
Then I would have to say I think this has been happening for a number of years, but short form seems to be more and more there's more and more storytelling. I mean, if you just even look at like TikTok and Instagram, that's happening in shorter and shorter windows of time. And I think even when you look at how many promos a show puts out, or how many, you know, the 9x16 version, for example, you know, that has changed storytelling. I mean, I think that for better or for worse, people are hungry for bite-sized pieces, and are hungry for direction in terms of their eyes, too. So who knows?
Focusing in aspect ratios. That's what I'm hearing.
I kind of think we've experienced a little bit of it in our display technology shift recently, I guess, in our display technology shift from SDR to HDR, especially at the consumer level, as those HDR OLEDs especially have come down in the type of home experience that people are having. I think that invites space for creatives to take even bigger swings and bigger kind of, I guess, chances, but Yeah, I think of a movie like Barbie, and the fact that people can enjoy that at home in HDR. It's like, wow. Yeah, I just think that we're getting to a space now where the home experience is pretty far up there. And I think that that's exciting for creatives to take risks.
Michael?
I have a little rant here. Going back to short form, I think the way short form is edited, where they take out all the breaths and there's no pacing and there's no nuance, and Gen Z accepts that as an edit, or they're used to it, or they expect it now. I think that's where AI is going to find its niche, because AI can edit that stuff stupidly like other people do. And so you don't need to worry about pacing and emotion. You know, it's just pull up, pull up, pull up, pull up, get the thought out. And you get ear fatigue because it's just, there's no pacing, there's no stopping. And you hear some great YouTubers, they have great information, but there's no pacing. And it's really, at least for a 50-something-year-old guy, it's exhausting. So I do see AI getting into more of that short form. But again, it's not going to take away from the art of real storytelling and more long form. I think that was that was it.
Well, to piggyback on that, I think it was last year, it might have been the year before last, there was a movie created out of a Twitter thread called Zola. So like, when we think about technologies and things changing and pacing, a story being told at the pace of a Twitter thread being adapted for the screen, it created all new kinds of ways to do visuals and audio. So I don't know. I'm always like, there's still hope. We can still get in there, and it, you know, that required a lot of creative to figure out how to adapt something in that form to a more long form traditional movie space.
Right. It's a story that might not have gotten told, you know. And I also worked on another show called Rap Shit, and the pilot, the original concept of the show was it was entirely going to be told through screens. And they did quickly realize that it is a little more digestible when there is more of a traditional narrative to it. But that is an interesting part of humans living right now, is that we have like this veneer of social media, and what you're presenting on FaceTime is different than what you're presenting on, you know, your social media profile. Is different than, you know, like a candid phone call that you're having is different when you're sitting and actually talking to somebody. So it's definitely revealing.
Another thing that's happened here is all of these different methodologies of storytelling, we can decide very quickly if they don't work. It's a concept called failing fast. We've tried it. It doesn't work. Let's go on to the next thing, or go back to the traditional way of doing things, or the more traditional way of doing things. Find out what doesn't work and then discard it.
Filmmakers too, it's like, just try it, you know, make your show, put it up, see if it lands, see if it sticks, you know. And you learn pacing, like it is learnable, all of those storytelling skills. And the more you're able to practice, like you're saying, the whole 10,000 hours thing, the more you get to refine. And it is nice that those tools have kind of, you know, democratized the point of entry a little bit too.
And storytelling also, you go back to like old history of film classes, sit through the Maltese Falcon, and you realize we don't tell things the same way as we did back then. And that was, you know, an example of awesome storytelling. So
Hitchcock.
Hitchcock's pacing is designed to build fear and anxiety. And there's a reason for it.
And then what we were saying before about this notion of play, right? As things change, creating that space inside of a color, like this is, we are on the frontier. This is where, as we ask these questions, we're in the space, we're using the tools where you play. And Control Z for undo is a lot lighter lift than a traditional undo. So I guess that means we should be playing more, right? Yeah.
See what sticks. So speaking of fear and anxiety, it's time for audience questions. So hands, and they'll be bringing microphones around.
So my question was for you about HDR. Have you found it interesting or difficult to like say, like, this is your average HDR that's going to be on the market, this is what I'm going to edit towards? Are you editing towards like the $20,000 monitor sitting in front of you that does like 2,000 nits?
We need typers.
Oh, yeah. No, you can't be too close. Okay. Well, that's an interesting question. I mean, in Dolby Vision, we now occasionally will have a 1,000 nit pass, a 600 nit pass, and a 100 nit pass. I think the whole point of dynamic metadata is that it's a handshake with the display set. So it's able to, you know, the math and the mapping is able to ideally give the home viewer the best picture possible. Also with the advent of filmmaker mode, for example, on the LG sets, that's a big advantage. Of course, they have to have that on at home. But I mean, I think that the reason we have standards is they're calibratable, and when things deviate in the wild, we know that they're going to deviate from that standard. I would say that the 1,000 nit pass is still pretty standard, but 4,000 is becoming a thing that people are asking for as the X3110 is available, and you know, it's no longer just the Pulsar able to do a 4,000 nit pass. But yeah, I think I would say that we, you know, always strive for the mastering monitor. And having a strong color management workflow allows our smaller color volume passes to be, you know, reproduced faithfully. Repeatable and reliable is my whole thing.
And these are containers that are expanding. And like you're saying, these containers keep us grounded technically. But how you map within that container is still, there's a creative element to that. So, you know, a DP, even though you have 1,000 nits available, maybe someone's like, hey, I really only want my candles to hit like 600. So there's still a creative element to it. It's just we have more room to explore.
There has been a little bit of study on average light levels in HDR content. So you can look those papers up on IEEE, those kinds of databases.
This is an interesting question. Who, when they get into a hotel room, immediately readjusts the television set? Not that many. So people aren't going for that optimum viewing experience either when it's not at their home.
When you're working with your DP or client, what are some questions you ask to try to understand how to grade the project, the look you want to give it? What are some creative questions you ask them to really understand what they want?
Amazing question. I mean, Rory might know this, but in my color bay, I always like to have photo books because sometimes people reference photography. But yeah, you just kind of are building a basis for that color language that I was talking about earlier. And as you listen to tastes and maybe things that are referenced, maybe it's a photo, maybe it's a feeling. You're really dissecting, okay, why are they gravitating towards this, and how do I translate that why into the tools that I have? That's for me.
Yeah. My last show, my DP and I were at a museum together, and there happened to be an exhibit for the photographer that was a hero reference for her in that show. So seeing that reference together in person was extremely valuable. I think looking at a lookbook is always a great idea. But I do always like to know how there's a, I think it's Neil deGrasse Tyson, that he was talking about like concept artists for Cosmos and saying like, I don't really want to know like exactly what it looks like when a space shuttle takes off because I already know that. I want to know how you feel. So I like to ask a lot of questions like, how do you feel? Or like what, you know, I also like to be really specific about, you know, something's too warm, like, okay, is it feeling too red warm or too gold warm? Or like, do you mean the entire picture is too warm? So that's, I just am a touchy-feely talker like that. I think words can do good.
It's back and forth. It's a concept, yeah. Back and forth until you're dialed, and then you're like, all right, we got it.
Yeah, yeah. That comfort is...
Yeah.
My question is kind of similar, actually. I guess it's kind of in the other direction. It's like, when trying to kind of bridge that gap with someone with their creative vision, is there some kind of topic that do you think they could kind of meet you halfway on that, like, you just wish, oh, if only they'd read this book on this one kind of niche area? Because obviously coloring is a very complicated, very dynamic thing to wrap your head around, and takes a lot of years to really properly understand it. So is there one thing that you kind of wish every creative that you had worked with had just had spent
1 hour kind of doing some research on, or is it just, it's you so like, you know, case by case basis?
It's the color book, you know, and there's a website, do you remember it, that you can look up any movie and get looks from those scenes? I'm sorry, I don't remember it, but it's out there. You subscribe and you can type in any movie title and what's it called? Shot Deck. Yeah. You call it any movie title. And then when you're on the same page with your DP, you can look through things, say, ah, this is where I'm going for, or more, this, but more chroma, or this, but darker. And that's the conversation you have. And you work off a single reference. It's not, you don't have to read a book. You have to have visuals.
I have a Munsell color tree in my color bay, which is an educational tool. It's a model, you know, color order system. And if you don't know, it's three axes. It's a hue axis, lightness axis, and then a chroma axis. And having that model can be really helpful. I think empowering people that, like, you're totally capable of describing what you want is really, it really changes a lot of conversations in a good, great direction.
Just, and making sure that it's like, whatever you suggest, we're going to try it out because we're in that space to try. So making sure that it's never a feeling of like, ooh, if I suggest this, I'm going to get a reaction. It's like, no, this is where we try it out and we kind of fine tune it. Sometimes people, they don't always have visual references. Sometimes they have sound references, music, like, can it feel like how this sound makes me feel? So it's a lot of back and forth and communication and navigating and just trying to figure out the same visual language for the project that you're on.
One great thing about DaVinci is you could have multiple versions of the same shot and you can keep going back and forth. You can go to one version, do a tweak, and then compare it to another version. You can have, is there a limit to how many versions you can have on a shot? No. Yeah. So that's a big help.
Kind of layer mixture. I'll use that on group nodes a lot. And then it's like, okay, here's the warm version. I just had that the other day. It's a transitional scene that was between day and night, and they wanted to take it into like to kind of bridge the gap between day and night. So we did like a warm dusk version, and then we did like a cold twilight version. And it was really nice to be able to be like, boink, it's on, boink, it's off.
And as you're in Resolve, organization is key, right? We're talking about, oh, let's try all this stuff out, right? You don't want to have that session. You've tried all this stuff out, and now your DP or EP's gone, and you're like, oh my gosh, what did we just do? So yes, using versions, labeling things, using a tree so you have a known spaces for where you try specific things, grabbing stills, labeling those stills so that you know what you discussed, so that the next day you're like, when we said warm, was it yellow warm? Or yeah, so yes.
I know you guys were saying something about pacing and how you guys felt like that was very important. And I just had another question. Was there any other elements in editing or coloring that you guys hold like very important, like key, like first number one? I just wanted to know your ideas.
So our job is to take all the little nuances between all the different takes or different cameras and match them.
See, we're on beat. It's matching. Oh, yeah. Because, yes, we're in a visible and an invisible art at the same time.
Yeah.
We are visibly creating the world that is distinct, but then once we're in that world, we want to stay in it. We don't want to be bumped out. So it is matching.
So how much do you depend on scopes? I'm always looking at the scopes to make sure things are looking good and my parade, everything's balanced. But how much do you look at the scopes and how much is it all just by eye?
A lot. I depend on scopes a lot. Yeah. I mean, you know, they're to keep you grounded, right? You know, it's that chromatic adaptation is a thing. Like you stare at something that looks pink for long enough and suddenly that looks gray and things that are neutral look green. And it's, it's a slippery slope. So, yeah, I mean, the scopes are always up. Tahir and I both use external scopes. And I don't know, Michael, if that's your...
built DaVinci, but I have it on a separate monitor. And I'd say for me, it's 50-50. You know, I'll do something visually. It's like, did I screw it up in the broadcast?
Nope.
Okay. And then vice versa. It's like, how far down can I get this to still be legal, but still look great on the screen?
When you're working in a room with groups or like, you know, when you have multiple people in the room and we're talking about there is an element of color that is subjective to your eyes. Scopes really help when you're like, yes,
yeah,
that is black. There's nothing, there's no blue in there, or that it's not lifted. Here we are on the scopes.
All right. Blackmagic Collective, Blackmagic Design, SNS, Keycode Media, Keepcode Education. Those are our sponsors. Thanks to them tonight for sponsoring this wonderful Stinded.
Thanks for watching Broadcast to Post. Please make sure to subscribe to the podcast to receive future episodes. Follow Keycode Media on LinkedIn, Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram to receive news on additional AV, broadcast, and post-production technology content. See you next time, folks.